The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Hooten, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, today's date is January 27, 2021. This panel of the court today has five cases on our calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A20-587, Berg versus Brown and others. Mr. Loftus, I believe you've been admitted pro hac vice. Welcome to Minnesota in a virtual sense. For the sake of both attorneys, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see the time clock on your screen if you maintain the right view settings, such as a gallery view. You will always be able to see that time clock. I believe we are ready to go. Counsel for appellant, you may please identify yourself and then you may begin.
Good morning, Alex Loftus for the appellants. May it please the court. This is should be a pretty simple matter. So what happened here was Berg was working for a company with one of the appellants, Alan Brown. They're working together at ARI. ARI was then purchased and the appellants were starting a new company, AW. Mr. Berg agreed to work for AW. In consideration of him going to work for AW, he was promised $240,000 in base wages, a phantom stock bonus if the company is profitable, and consulting fees paid to an LLC for work done on the clerical and accounting side of the business, which wasn't his normal job, paid once the company was profitable. Now, Berg got the wages, $240,000, and the company wasn't profitable, so he didn't get the bonus. He didn't do the consulting work on the clerical side of the business, and the company wasn't profitable, so he wasn't paid for that. Prior to Berg being terminated from AW, he breached his fiduciary duties to AW. He was paying an employee that didn't do work, and he was starting his own company. Ultimately, he wasn't very successful in the breach of fiduciary duties and didn't cause too much damages. Now, Berg wound up winning what the court acknowledged was a very weak case. Frankly, this case shouldn't have gone to a jury. The big issue we're talking about today is this waiver question. So appellee's taken an interesting position that the arguments as to the entry of judgment as a matter of law were all waived because there was no post-trial motion. That's just plainly incorrect, and that's not the law in the state.
Mr. Loftus, let's go to the issue of the JMOL motion with respect to the fraud claim. I mean, which elements of a fraud cause of action do you believe were not proved, or which elements is the evidence lacking?
We'll start with the easiest one. Berg received what he was promised. He was promised wages.
I think the parties agree on the elements. I'm looking at the Hoyt case. I think both parties cite the Hoyt case for the elements of the offense. Based on your answer, I'm not clear where that fits into the five elements of that claim.
It's proximate cause and damages, both. So he was promised wages and a phantom stock bonus, and the phantom stock bonus was paid if the company was profitable. There's no question the company was not profitable, so he did not receive the bonus, and he did receive the wages. So he was offered these things, and that is what he received. That's the easiest argument, and the evidence was clear on that point.
Are you challenging? I think one of the elements of the claim is that there was a false statement, a false representation of fact. Are you challenging that element?
Yes, there was no evidence of a false statement of fact. So what the fraud claim kind of morphed during trial compared to what is pled. What is pled is this, that he did not receive what he was promised. What it morphed into a trial is whether Alan Brown made a false statement of fact as to whether Mr. Berg was still owed a bonus from the prior employer. What the testimony showed is that Mr. Brown was genuinely confused as to whether or not Mr. Berg was owed a bonus from ARI. The testimony showed that Mr. Brown was also shorted his bonus from ARI, and that was subject to further litigations ongoing. So he was confused, and there was testimony showing why he was confused and how he was confused and at what point he communicated these things to Mr. Berg. Tying directly to that is a question of reasonable reliance. So was it reasonable for Mr. Berg to rely solely on Mr. Brown to tell him whether or not his former employer, ARI, owed him a bonus? And there was no evidence showing that that was reasonable to rely solely on him and not simply contact ARI and the remaining executives there regarding his bonus. Now, unfortunately,
because I know you're making arguments and you're presenting it from the Brown standpoint, mm-hmm. but Berg had a whole different version of what occurred here that the jury obviously believed. How can we adopt your client's version over that of Mr. Berg?
First, you don't need to get there. So if you go with this actual recitation of whether or not Berg believed that he was entitled to a bonus from ARI, doesn't matter. ARI is not a party here. Whether or not ARI paid him a bonus has nothing to do with the claim. The claim is what he was receiving from AW. So you have this sideshow of ARI not paying him a bonus and the poor man didn't get his bonus from ARI. That has nothing to do with his employment with AW, a separate company.
But wasn't the representation made to him that bonus was owed by the Browns? And that they intended that it would be paid as part of his relationship in future companies they might have?
There's no testimony or evidence connecting the two. So if Browns genuinely believed and they promised, or let's just assume that Browns lied and they fraudulently said that he's going to get a bonus from a third party. So what? That was not a condition of him joining AW. And there was no evidence presented that that was a condition of the agreement that induced him to join. The two things operate independently. Now, what really hamstrung us here is that the reality is that Mr. Berg was able to separately secure some of his bonus from ARI, and we were not allowed to inquire as to that at trial. That kind of muddied the whole waters. Now, the court, in the pretrial stages, it made sense because the bonus from ARI shouldn't have had to do with anything. And it was just why introduce this whole line of facts? What wound up happening is in the course of trial, the case became very much about Berg not getting his bonus from this third party and then not being able to present evidence that he was paid. And more importantly, that it's not so much the amount that he was paid, but the fact that he could call up ARI and negotiate payment of this money independently of the appellants is really the key fact that didn't get into evidence.
And Mr. Loftus, then the judge though seemed to suggest, said that the evidence though presented to the jury was that the Browns would have incentive to lure Berg, and that's the connection as I understand it and what the judge understood the facts that were presented to the jury with regard to the bonus. So whether it was originally to come from ARI, but ultimately they wanted him, we will give you the bonus. That's essentially a paraphrase of what the judge said the evidence suggested. So if that's the case, then it that follows up Judge Hooten's point is the jury was presented with both theories and ruled against your client.
The jury was not presented with a theory that it was an either or, that he would get that in exchange for foregoing the bonus from ARI, he would get a bonus from AW. That was not presented, and there was no evidence showing that. Does that make sense? That answer your question?
But am I correct? The point being, though, is that the jury was given evidence of the interest the Browns had in luring Berg to them, which then tied with the evidence of you will get to receive a phantom stock, which the judge attributes to the Browns. And maybe that's the statement you're referring to of Mr. Brown in particular. All of that together, would that not naturally follow that therefore there was a goal to get him and by a promise of a phantom stock?
Oh, exactly. Yes, it is exactly what it was. That they very much wanted to work with Mr. Berg. Mr. Berg could provide value to their company. They agreed to pay him a very handsome wage, and they agreed to give him a phantom stock bonus if they made money. And they gave him those things.
So how does it not naturally follow that the jury could find that that was a false statement because there was never an intention to pay a phantom stock, but they wanted to lure Mr. Berg to their company?
It doesn't matter if there was an intention or not. So the jury could say they intended to screw him out of the phantom stock bonus. So what? There was no phantom stock bonus because it was not profitable.
You've referenced a couple of times the profitability. The judge also, and that tie seems to relate both to the breach of contract, perhaps, and the fraud claim. But the judge, in her order, indicated the evidence suggested, well, number one, there was no written agreement as to the contingency ultimately signed. And therefore, the jury was left again with the two possibilities, one that it may be subject to profitability and one that it's not. How do we intervene on a jury's decision in that regard?
You can review the record and what's in the briefs. It's clear that there's no affirmative testimony contradicting that the payment was not. I mean, so the only testimony from Mr. Berg that it was not conditioned upon profitability was then immediately impeached in the next line of testimony. So that is the only evidence supported, was then immediately impeached the next line later with his own email. So based on that, there's no competent evidence that it was going to be paid regardless of profitability.
Could I get back to the settlement agreement? I know that you thought the judge erred by not allowing that agreement in. And I assume that would be an abuse of discretion standard for reviewing that. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's abuse of discretion.
And the judge basically noted that there are so many aspects that are involved in any settlement agreement. The Browns hadn't done discovery in getting all those issues that may have been pertinent to the settlement agreement. And he thought it'd be confusing to the jury to hear about the settlement agreement and to allow cross-examination on that. Why was that an abuse of discretion in that the judge thought it would be misleading or confusing to the jury?
Ultimately, she drew the lines too broadly. I can appreciate the point on narrowing the questioning on that topic, but ultimately the key issue here is whether he was able to communicate directly with ARI regarding his bonus and whether he received something. And that's all we needed to show. And that would demonstrate that there was no reason to rely on appellants for this bonus and communications regarding this bonus. We could have left out the exact amount. We could have left out many things, but the key was that he was able to communicate directly with them. And by casting this very wide net to exclude all of this possible evidence, it was an abuse of discretion. And ultimately it proved out in the eventual result where the verdict for the fraud was exactly what the bonus was owed from ARI. Make sense? The other thing I really wanted to touch on was the issues of the breach of contract and the statute of frauds and the indefinite nature of the agreement. These were some clear legal questions that should have been resolved by the court rather than the jury. First, there's testimony as to the duration of the contract. Essentially, they adopted a written agreement is as an oral agreement, and the written agreement provided for a 2-year term. So that should have been precluded by the statute of frauds. The argument against that is that rather than it being a 2-year term, it was indefinite. I go in some detail in the reply brief that if this is indefinite and there are no clear terms as to what this is, then it's equally unenforceable. This is a legal question that should have been addressed by the court and disposed of on a motion for judgment as a matter of law. You have any further questions? Not, I'll close with that. Thank you.
Yep, it appears not. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Loftus.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself, please, and begin.
Thank you. Good morning, honorable judges of the panel, counsel. My name is Scott Moriarty. I'm appearing on behalf of the respondents, Eric Berg and Eric Berg Consulting. Appellants are making a rather extraordinary argument. They are calling for the overturning of a jury verdict, a jury that heard several days of testimony and saw dozens of exhibits relating to this case. Respondents have striven to put the relevant trial record before this court so that they could see the nature of the evidence that was put before them. It is respondents' position that to the extent appellants are challenging the sufficiency of the evidence for that jury verdict, the trial record must be construed with reasonable inferences for that verdict. And that unless there was an error of law, that verdict must be upheld.
Mr. Mayor Moriarty, in your brief at page 22, you state the elements of the offense, citing the Hoyt case. The first element is that the defendant made a false representation of a past or existing material fact susceptible of knowledge. So what was that false representation in this case?
The false representation was that Mr. Berg, in exchange for relinquishing his phantom stock interest with a predecessor, all staff companies, would receive a phantom stock interest in a successor company, which was originally contemplated to be all staff companies, but that never came to pass because the Browns did not actually have an ownership interest in that company, and later in AW companies.
Isn't that a statement about a future act rather than a past or existing material fact?
No, because the precise promise was to the grant of a phantom stock interest in a company. That's a present and existing fact, and that was the precise ruling of the district court in this case.
When was that representation made?
It was made, and there's backing for this in the second volume of the trial transcript on pages 138 through 141 and page 181 of the testimony of Mr. Berg about the representations that the Browns made, the specific representations on October 30th, which was at the dawn of the formation of AW companies, relating to him receiving that phantom stock interest at that time.
Okay, and I assume then you would say that your client relied on that representation by accepting employment with AW, correct?
It was not an issue that was raised either in the motion for judgment as a matter of law or addressed by the district court in its order or by the appellants in their appellate brief. However, that is our position that Mr. Berg relied on the representations of the Browns and had reason to do so based on their history of trust together.
So it's appellant's theory that Berg did receive a right to a phantom equity buyout, but that the calculation of the amount depended on profitability and the company wasn't profitable. Isn't that undisputed?
That is in fact disputed. There is competent evidence. Well, actually that goes to damages. And to be frank, the notion here is that Mr. Berg was induced to relinquish a pre-existing phantom stock bonus in the belief that he was going to get something of equal or greater value. And that was not challenged at trial. So the measure of the damage is out-of-pocket loss.
Okay, I guess I'm not sure if that answers my question. Respondent's position is they told him you will get a right to, I think it's called a phantom stock bonus payment. And it's their position that he did have such a right, and that's paid after the end of employment, but that it depends, you know, but the measurement or the calculation is based upon profitability. And they said that the company wasn't profitable, and therefore he had a right to a payment of zero, I guess. But and that seems undisputed to me. So I don't understand why the statement that they made was false.
At the time that they made the statements, it was a phantom stock interest in the company that was going to come into existence. At that time, there's evidence of intent to defraud that they never intended to relay that phantom stock interest to Mr. Berg at all. That their intention simply was to appropriate Mr. Berg's client, Meyer, a major client from the predecessor company, and that they never intended to honor phantom stock interest to begin with. And that was borne out by the party's actions after AW Companies acquired that major client. So the fact that the phantom stock interest may or may not have generated a certain amount of money is frankly immaterial to the fraud. The fraud was accomplished at the point in time that Mr. Berg brought his major client over to AW Companies. And at that point, he suffered the out-of-pocket loss because the Browns relinquished, the Browns induced Mr. Berg to relinquish his prior phantom stock interest with the understanding he would be getting something, and they never gave him anything.
But they never, I mean, did the company deny him a phantom stock bonus payment to which he was entitled?
Well, they didn't deny him the payment. They denied him the interest outright. They didn't grant him any phantom stock interest in AW Companies. They took the old phantom stock interest. They took the client. They never granted him a phantom stock interest at all. If there had been a phantom stock interest.
What's the evidence that they never granted him the interest?
The testimony showing that they pushed for the separation of the companies, the fact that they never memorialized the terms of the phantom stock interest in writing.
Well, and, I mean, Wendy Brown sent him a contract on November 4, which, you know, Wendy Brown offered it to him on behalf of AW, and he did not sign it, it appears. So doesn't that indicate that AW was willing to give him that? All he had to do was sign it, I think.
If the trial record is construed with inferences against the verdict and in favor of the appellants, then that is one possible interpretation of the facts here. However, the jury had ample reason to conclude on this trial record that there was an intent to defraud from the beginning, that the reason why that proffered contract in November of 2017, the reason why it wasn't signed was because of the incipient lawsuit that was then brought immediately against the Browns, charging them with misappropriation of the business. And it was due to those issues and a general lack of trust that resulted in the phantom stock interest never being memorialized or implemented. The goal
so
of-
now, So now, so your statement now that they never intended, even at the time of making the statement, that's sort of a separate theory under the fraud law, right? Separate from the usual way of proving a false statement made with knowledge of its falsity. I guess, didn't the district court basically disavow this theory in the post-trial JML order? I'm looking at page 4 of her order, footnote 2. She says that, she said that there is case law saying that a fraud claim could be based upon a statement concerning the future. However, that's not what we're doing here. Isn't that true?
To be more specific, Your Honor, the case law and what the court was hailing to was actually establishes two separate and equally viable theories in support of the fraud here. One is that the promise was made fraudulently with no intent to honor the promise from the start. The other is that the promise was made with a reckless disregard for the truth and that there was no genuine intention to follow through with the material terms of the transaction. Under either of those theories, there's going to be sufficient evidence of intent to defraud. And there is case law supporting the notion that when a promisor makes a promise, but harbors fraudulent intent and has no intention of honoring the terms of the promise, that is in fact a fraud. And that
the district court didn't buy that theory, correct?
I respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that the district court did recognize that that was a possible theory here. The only issue, the specific issue in the footnote was relating to whether this was a representation of future value or whether this was a representation of a present right. And the district court concluded that this is in fact involving a present right, whether or not a phantom stock interest was being conveyed to Mr. Berg or not.
So if, are you not claiming or not arguing now on appeal that a fraudulent statement was made concerning Mr. Berg's entitlement to a phantom stock payment from ARI? Is that or is that not an alleged fraudulent statement on which you're basing your claim?
The claim is based on fraudulent statements about Mr. Berg receiving a phantom stock interest in a successor to ARI, which originally was contemplated to be the ARI that the Browns were going to purchase, but did not, and then a phantom stock interest in AW companies.
And then, okay, so let me go back to, to reiterate, what's the evidence that AW denied him the phantom stock interest that they had promised?
They never memorialized or granted him any cognizable stock interest. And when he asked to have those, when they were negotiating an effort to memorialize those terms in March and April of the following year, the Browns just refused and they kept on adding additional conditions to the grant of the phantom stock interest. It was a material change
Which conditions were added?
The Browns started insisting on additional terms that were never discussed relating to his power to compete, whether he could
in the company or not. Wasn't that term also in the agreement that was offered on November 4, the non-compete, non-solicitation?
Well, these were additional matters that were added and that were not discussed at the time.
I thought that the non-compete, non-solicitation was part of the November 4 proposed agreement. Am I incorrect about that?
I don't recall whether it's the exact same language or not. Mr. Berg there wasn't any sort of meaningful discussion between the parties at the time around November 4th about executing that contract or not. Because at that point, the fraud had already been accomplished and they had also been enjoined from doing further business. And there was reason for them not to revisit the contract at that time. And they didn't. And frankly, they started doing business with one another without executing the contract at all. And the trial testimony bears that out. It was only after the parties' relationship started to deteriorate that the Browns started manifesting their intention, started to reveal that they were no longer interested in honoring what they had promised back in October of 2017.
With respect to what?
With respect to the phantom stock bonus,
where is that evidence in the record? Is that in a written, like an email, or is it in oral testimony?
It's in oral testimony. Let me see if I can provide the court with a more precise. So there was testimony about, the second volume, the trial transcript at 159 and 160, about Mr. Berg becoming aware that the that the Browns were not willing to honor their prior promises about granting him a phantom stock interest in AW companies. And at the time,
okay, I'm sorry, you may complete your answer if you wish.
Certainly. And the district court also found that not only that the Browns failed to complete the transaction, but also that there's trial testimony demonstrating that there were no concerns at the time of the verbal agreements in October of 2017 that writing was required. And that's in the testimony, second volume of the transcript, pages 147 to 150 and at 159.
And I just want to make sure, is it your argument today that what was presented to the jury was that that there was an agreement that he would not pursue immediately his right to the phantom stock in the prior company, but that but there was some agreement as to how that stock would later be paid. Am I correct?
The nature of the fraud was that Mr. Burke relinquished his phantom stock interest in the legacy all-staff recruiting company. He was bargaining with the Browns with the understanding that Mr. Brown was the seller and Ms. Brown was the buyer, and that those were the two interested parties in the transaction. Mr. Brown induced Mr. Burke to relinquish his legacy phantom stock interest, and that flowed from Mr. Brown to Ms. Brown. And there's repeated trial testimony to that effect multiple times in the transcript where both Mr. Burke and Ms. Brown acknowledged that that's where that funding was to flow to. And it was with the understanding that he was relinquishing that legacy interest to get a new phantom stock interest.
There was a lot of testimony about whether Mr. Brown was accurate in saying that ARI would owe him a payment of $75,000. And apparently the ARI company took a position at some point that he was not entitled to anything. So if Mr. Berg had understood that he was entitled to no payment from ARI instead of a payment of $75,000 from ARI, what would Mr. Berg have done differently?
If I understand the question of the court, the question here is, was Mr. Burke's reliance reasonable? Had he known what the value of a phantom stock interest was worth? To just briefly walk through the evidence on that point, there was testimony from Mr. Alan Brown that he knew no later than mid-October of 2017 that the legacy phantom stock interest was worth nothing. There's also a trial exhibit, I believe it's trial exhibit 12, which is an email that Mr. Alan Brown sent to Mr. Berg in December of 2017. So after Mr. Brown allegedly discovered that the legacy phantom stock bonus was worth nothing, he sends an email to Mr. Berg saying, no, it's actually worth $75,000. There's also multiple emails that corroborate that $75,000 figure, where it was held out as, this is the value of the phantom stock interest that you are relinquishing in exchange for this new interest in the new company. So the theory on the evidence here is that at the time, Mr. Alan Brown controlled all the information about what the value of that phantom stock interest was worth. That Mr. Burke had no independent source for that information besides Mr. Brown, and then he trusted Mr. Brown. And so his reliance on the information that he received from Mr. Brown was reasonable. That also intertwines with intent to defraud, because if at the time of those representations, Mr. Brown knew that the phantom stock was worth nothing or believed that it was worth nothing, yet continued to hold out that it was worth something to Mr. Burke, that corroborates evidence of an intention to defraud.
Judge Johnson, may I ask another question?
Certainly.
Why was it not an abuse of discretion for the judge to keep from the jury the fact that he had a claim against ARI and that that claim was settled with regard to this phantom stock?
Multiple reasons. Among them, the controlling Minnesota Supreme Court precedent in Frey v. Snellgrove that states that information about the amount paid in settlement should never be submitted. And the concerns that the court expressed there are the exact same concerns here. We don't know what the relationship of that settlement is to the damages in this case. We don't know what the claims are. And we don't know whether that would prejudice the jury's determination of damages. Also, just so that the court has the background of the record on this, there was a single letter filed in the case where Mr. Brown acknowledged settlement with other stakeholders in ARI. There was no discovery on this point. The settlement was never actually received by the appellants. They have no idea what the value of the settlement is or what claims were being settled in connection with that discussion. And there was no offer of proof or post-trial practice with regard to the settlement. For all of those reasons, not to mention just not wasting the jury's time with information that had the potential to be prejudicial, the exclusion of that settlement was not an abuse of discretion.
Now, isn't it true that, I mean, in many cases, evidence about a settlement is relevant only to damages, but in this case, this would have been directly relevant to one of the fighting issues, and that was whether Mr. Brown accurately inform Mr. Berg about his entitlement to a payment from ARI, which was seemed to be suggestions. I mean, you've said now in oral argument this is not the strictly speaking the basis of your fraud claim, but there was a lot of testimony and argument that Mr. Brown told him his payment was he was entitled to a $75,000 payment, even though the company had taken the position that Mr. Berg was not entitled to anything. So, I mean, wouldn't this evidence have gone to the question about whether Mr. Brown was speaking accurately and honestly?
Without divulging the terms of a confidential settlement with non-parties, all I can say is that maybe it could have and maybe it couldn't have, but based on the record that was put before the district court, there was no abuse of discretion in excluding this settlement agreement.
I have no further questions. If neither of the other judges has any questions, then we will turn to rebuttal argument from Mr. Loftus. Thank you, Mr. Moriarty.
Thank you.
So
you may begin.
Oh, thank you. Ultimately, this is a breach of contract case parading as a fraud. The written agreement provided that Mr. Berg's going to get the phantom stock bonus. The written agreement also provided that Berg would enter into a non-compete. This is an ordinary term for these things. Mr. Berg refused to sign the agreement with the non-compete in it for several months as this went on and on and on. Despite not signing the agreement, he continued to get paid the generous salary. So ultimately, if this were pled as a breach of contract, it is, you know, he failed to perform. Well, he didn't even agree to the non-compete, and he failed to perform the non-compete, which is really what's in consideration of the phantom stock. So there is a very clear intent to always give Mr. Berg the phantom stock. The easiest path here as to this phantom stock idea is that there are no damages because there's no evidence of value in the phantom stock. This is a startup company that was laboring under this tremendous weight of litigation, and it was not profitable. So the very simple path here is that there is no fraud claim because there is no damages. That's just the simple path. And that is consistent with what the jury found, which is by assigning damages based on this other thing. The other big issue, this fraud claim, is that what is pled is not really what we've been discussing. So what's pled, and I detail this on page 26 of my brief, is that he's promised the phantom stock. He doesn't get the phantom stock. He's promised something like what he had. Berg has promised something like what he had with ARI, and he does not receive that, which is the phantom stock. There is no allegation pled, nor was the jury instructed, that he was deprived of his ARI money, and that as a result of being deprived of his ARI money, he's entitled to get paid that back. Of course, that's not what the claim was, because ARI is not a party, and there was some litigation early in the case and issues over that settlement and why ARI was not a party to the case. And some claims were disposed of because ARI was not a party to the case. So all that is pled, and we are locked in with what the pleadings are, and this is how the court should have ruled on the judgment as a matter of law, is based on what the pleadings are. And the pleadings are that he is promised a phantom stock bonus and that he was offered the phantom stock bonus. He didn't sign the document to take the phantom stock bonus. Had he signed it and received it, it would be zero. So by any measure, it just doesn't support a verdict in favor of fraud on that count. That's about all I got on the fraud, unless you have further questions on that. The other issue I wanted to make sure that the court addresses is the jury instruction on the forfeiture. It was clear coming into the case that we would have a hard time showing meaningful on the breach of fiduciary duty. Because ultimately Mr. Berg solicited customers and then wasn't successful. And then Mr. Berg solicited employees and wasn't successful. And then Mr. Berg's mother was working in a job where she was overcompensated by a nominal amount. So Minnesota law supports that when you're breaching your duties to a company, you are not entitled to your wages and you have to forfeit that. And we should have been allowed that instruction. I think had we been allowed that instruction, we would have likely wound up with probably a zero as the end result. It would have balanced the fraud claim at the very least. The question should have been, how much of those wages does he have to forfeit, and whether it's, and then we'd have to show at what point he breached his duties of loyalty, which that could have been a small amount that, in the last 2 months of his job, he's breaching his duties. But that should have been the question, not completely eliminating the instruction altogether. So if we're going to have to try this case again, very respectfully suggest that the court provide some clarity to the trial court on how to deal with that instruction of the forfeiture of wages. And that's all I have. And thank you all very much for your time. I'm so grateful for Zoom that I didn't have to drive up in the snow. So I kind of hope we keep doing this. I enjoy the in-person, but this is nice for my basement.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Loftus. Thank you to both attorneys for your argument. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. The court will now be in recess until 10:20, which is the scheduled time of the oral argument for the next case.